him with love, forgiveness, and salvation. Those people learned that from the great teacher Clement of Pinckney. His legacy is the lessons that he taught and the life that he lived.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, taking this time from Spartanburg. You're headed to Columbia, where this discussion, this debate is going to take place. Republican South Carolina State Representatives Doug Brannon and Gary Clary speaking to us from Columbia. Reverend Dr. William Barber speaking to us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Historian Don Doyle from Columbia. And David Goodman joining us here in New York, brother of Andrew Goodman. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Tuesday KBOO Evening News.
It takes all of us to keep KBOO strong. KBOO is your radio station. Did you know that you can give gifts of stock to KBOO? We are able to quickly turn these donations into support for the important daily work of KBOO. How do you do this? Call 503-231-8032, extension 201, or email monica@kboo.org for information on how to make a stock gift. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Eastmoreland residents make a very expensive deal with developers to save three very old sequoia trees.
South Carolina lawmakers have introduced a bill to take down the Confederate battle flag from their state capital.
And a Methodist church group is calling for an end to the war on drugs.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. A group of Eastmoreland residents held a protest this morning in front of three ancient sequoia trees. The neighborhood is located south of Reed College near Woodstock. The neighbors have banded together in a campaign to stop the destruction of the trees. Everett Custom Homes was planning to cut the trees in the next week, but as of today, the neighbors were able to negotiate a deal to pay $950,000 for the property in order to preserve the trees. Vic Remmers, the president of Everett Custom Homes, only agreed to the deal if the residents could come up with $50,000 by the end of business today, and the balance of $900,000 by July 3rd. The $50,000 payment is non-refundable. If they don't raise the remainder of the money, they will lose that money and the trees will come down. The trees are each about 150 years old. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Robert McCullough of the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association.
I wonder if you could tell us what the latest development is on the three threatened sequoia trees in the neighborhood.
Well, this morning we had, I would estimate, 100 neighbors there in the most polite sit-in known to man. Mr. Remmer's equipment did not show up. And at 10:30, we went and met with Mr. Remmer's and hammered out a deal. The deal is for the neighbors to purchase the property. Part of the Remmer's strategy is to demand very unusual time limits. It's not immediately clear what's happening between 4:30 and 5 today. Perhaps someone is missing their nap at Everett Custom Homes. But the reality is that it's a good deal for them. Now, under this, the neighborhood would preserve the 350-foot sequoias. We understand those are 170 years old. The deal would close on July 2nd, I am told. So the good news is that a nonviolent demonstration and a little common sense goes a long way.
And how is it that those trees were threatened to begin with? Are they not heritage trees? Is there not some protection from the city?
One of the things we're finding out is there are really no protections in the city. Everett Custom Homes, if they cut them, had to pay a fine of $4,800. The market price of the wood in the trees is many times that. So the penalties for the new tree law really provide very little protection for trees. These were not officially heritage trees simply because the previous owner probably never understood the importance of it. They were elderly. They've now passed away. So what it means is that a lot of the development just involves clear-cutting parts of the city. It's one of the reasons why parts of the city and probably all of the city have fewer trees every year. We really have very little protection on environmental issues such as this.
And in this particular case, are the neighbors prepared to put up $900,000? That's no small amount of money.
It isn't, and it's going to require a wider group than just the neighbors. We sent out a request to 4,000 individuals this afternoon. I'm told there has been a good response. The difficulty, of course, is, in this case, Everett Custom Homes, in a sense, outsmarted itself. It's nice to actually ambush the neighborhood, but if you're actually trying to maximize your profits, talking to the neighbors is a lot more profitable than ambush. So we're seeing whether or not the arbitrary time limits that they've set will end up hurting Everett Custom Homes. And this is a very strange world the city code has set up, where a builder will buy a lot at a discount and then effectively hold it hostage and at the same time threaten to destroy irreplaceable trees, in a sense sort of as a hostage. Now, this is private enterprise, and in Portland, private enterprise is king. But nonetheless, the best way to do anything is to do it openly and to talk it through and to figure out what the right solution is. The hardest way to do it is, as we're doing it today, last minute, under a lot of pressure, under the threat of the immediate destruction of these beautiful heritage trees.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I was speaking with Robert McCullough, chair of the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association, and that email address, if you are interested in finding out more about the sequoia trees or getting involved, is robert@mresearch.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Over the weekend, the New England Conference of United Methodist Churches, which represents 600 congregations, voted for a resolution that calls for a complete end to the war on drugs. The resolution points to Christian principles of redemption and restoration to replace the current system of punitive sanctions against drug users, and reads in part, "In the love of Christ, who came to save those who are lost and vulnerable, we urge the creation of a genuinely new system for the care and restoration of victims, offenders, criminal justice officials, and the community as a whole. Restorative justice grows out of biblical authority, which emphasizes a right relationship with God, self, and community. When such relationships are violated or broken through crime, opportunities are created to make things right." The resolution concludes by asking the government to seek means other than prohibition to address the problem of substance abuse.
The Oregon House Rules Committee voted today to approve a measure delaying hemp production in the state. House Bill 2668 would allow the State Department of Agriculture to begin issuing hemp production permits in 2017. The Agriculture Department would then have to rescind the 13 hemp production permits it has already issued. The measure sets up a 5-mile buffer zone between hemp production and land use to produce marijuana for medical or adult use. It also prohibits hemp production within 1,000 feet of schools, even though industrial hemp cannot be used as a drug. Andrea Herman, the president of the Hemp Industries Association, testified before a legislative committee about hemp and the buffer zone back in February. Here's part of her testimony.
My name is Andrea Herman. I am physically located in Manitoba, Canada, where I've been working here with the hemp industry for the last 15 years and 20 years overall in the hemp sector. I am an authorized hemp sampler for the federal government here in Canada and work globally on legislation. In addition, I am an instructor at Oregon State University for eCampus course WSE 266 on industrial hemp. I am a professional agrologist working in large-scale agriculture, hemp agriculture, in addition to economy of scale agriculture. I was brought in to the topic pertaining to the cross-pollination issue potential between industrial hemp and marijuana. I have gone on the record stating that it is a risk for our colleagues in the marijuana sector to have industrial hemp growing in close proximity. What that proximity is the burning question. I do not have a defined answer to what the minimal safe distance between different types of the generic cannabis resulting in impurities in their offspring. All we can go on essentially is the OASCA's draft or the OASCA standards for seed certification. If we look at their certification, and this has been adopted, is being drafted, adopted into the United States from the Canadian regulations. The minimal distance between two types is 500 meters, so approximately 3 miles. Is 3 miles enough to prevent pollinization? More than likely, I would say professionally not. We know how far wind can travel. Depends on where the location is, the moisture in the air, the heat, perhaps on how long that male pollen stays viable. But as we know, when we're talking about the cultivation of industrial hemp for in purposes of either fiber only or for grain or seed production, when you're growing industrial hemp for a fiber-only type of application, typically you're taking the crop down when the males are starting to pollinate, but before the females are receptive in industrial hemp. So some people may say that that would be one option for cultivation practices or cutting for silage. It still would not prevent any male plants from opening. From working in the breeding plots, you are starting to really rope those plants or remove any off types really early on, and you can still have male plants forming quite early in the season within the first 1 to 1.5 months. You can start to see male plants starting to form in the field when we're talking about maintaining these. And these are when you're in the plots every other day maintaining those. Of course, our colleagues in the medical cannabis adult use marijuana sector, I being one of those people, knowing that you prevent the males from appearing at all. It could be a huge economic disaster and hardship for a marijuana grower that's indoor or outdoor production has been contaminated by male pollen, and no guarantees of how to really protect that. Even with indoor, how good are the filters? We do not have regulations in the Canadian industry or in any other hemp industry that I know of that has faced this dilemma right on. Underneath a political framework, I can say that from personal experience, when I first came to Manitoba and met people that were in the marijuana growing industry, some of those granted at that time were operating underneath our medical access program. In the area that I came where hemp was introduced, they didn't really smile too much knowing that I was a hemp person, because essentially they had told me that all of the hemp coming to the area had basically pushed out any marijuana operation or pushed out any homegrown or indoor a homegrown type of operation because of the amount of pollen that was coming in. And granted, this was a larger amount of acres that was coming in into an area. So I can say that there is a risk. There is potentially some options with regions, but how do you decide that region? A question I have is if, you know, what happens if somebody comes and buys land on the intention of cultivating industrial hemp on it, and then that land sits fallow for a year or so, and they come back and they have a medical marijuana facility that has been permitted in the area. I'm not for sure how that's going to work, you know, for such as if you're going to have to make a public announcement that you're intending on building a marijuana facility, and if anybody has an issue with that in a particular region, how would that impact the farming community?
That was hemp expert Andrea Herman testifying before the state's Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91. HB 2668 now goes to the Ways and Means Committee.
Portland's small supply of affordable housing may be increasing following a review this morning by the City Council. Oregon is currently one of two states that does not allow local governments to mandate the construction of affordable housing units. The newly proposed concept would allow building developers to build taller buildings only if they also commit to building rent-restricted housing units. Commissioner Dan Saltzman says that he believes this is an important tool to encourage the private market to be part of the solution to our affordable housing crisis. The units will be available to people earning up to 80% of the region's median income. If the concept gets approved, the City Council will begin to formalize a proposal next month.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership has moved another step closer to becoming a reality. The Senate voted today to approve a cloture motion limiting debate on the Trade Promotion Authority Bill, or TPA. This means that the TPA itself could be voted on by the Senate as early as Wednesday. The cloture motion received the minimum 60 votes needed to be approved, with 37 senators voting against and 3 not voting. Oregon's delegation was split, with Senator Jeff Merkley voting against the motion, while Ron Wyden voted in favor. The TPA is also called the Fast Track Bill. If TPA is approved, then Congress will not be allowed to amend the TPP. Instead, they will only be allowed a vote to reject or approve the trade deal as a whole. The House already narrowly approved the TPA last week, so if it passes the Senate, the measure will go to the President's desk for his signature.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. For the past few weeks, I've been visiting big cities and small towns in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa to lead my workshops on dismantling corporate rule and replacing it, at least locally, with a newly empowered citizenry, ready and able to define the future they want for their community and start to realize it through the community rights lawmaking. The final 3 days of my trip, I spent in Ashland, Wisconsin, on the south shore of Lake Superior. This absolutely enormous lake continues to be under assault these days from proposed corporate activities that could poison the rivers and creeks flowing into the lake. Recently, a very impressive alliance of Native and non-Native groups successfully stopped what would have been one of the largest iron mines ever proposed in the world. The biggest issue for the local residents is water and how easily that water could be poisoned. Lake Superior Ojibwa communities harvest wild rice and fish from Lake Superior as a major source of their food and culture. All of the local communities draw their drinking water from the local rivers. Now that the proposed mine has been stopped, the next critical project to stop is a proposed CAFO, which is shorthand for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, better known as a factory farm. I led an introductory community rights workshop for a few dozen concerned citizens on this issue, and the group appeared to be ready to launch a local community rights ordinance to prohibit any corporate CAFOs from being placed here in Ashland County, Wisconsin. I traveled to northern Wisconsin with my colleague and friend Al Geddix, who has become one of the leading voices in the U.S. working to stop large corporate mining operations here and around the world. Al is professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse and has authored 2 books on this topic. Their titles are The New Resource Wars and Resource Rebels. I asked Al to tell me a bit about his anti-mining work and why he feels that a community rights approach is a worthwhile strategy to challenge what has become an endless parade of proposed corporate assaults on our human and wildland communities. Al, thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure to be here. I first got involved with the Mole Lake Chippewa Tribe, or Ojibwa Tribe, in northern Wisconsin in 1976, when Exxon Minerals proposed a large-scale copper-zinc mine operation right next to their reservation and a mile upstream from their wild rice beds. The wild rice is a major source of their food, their culture, and the proposed mine would have released contaminants into the water, the stream that flowed from the mine site into the tribe's wild rice lake. So members of the tribal council approached me and asked me for help in stopping the mine. And when I began to organize supporters and allies in the battle to stop this mine, I logically approached the state's environmental organizations, and I was told in no uncertain terms that they could not support a campaign to stop a mine because it was unrealistic, it had little chance of winning, and furthermore, that they had stood a better chance of regulating the mine and creating laws that would minimize environmental pollution. When the tribe heard that message, they said, no thanks, we're going to go our own way. And I proceeded to organize local community, the surrounding communities around the Indian reservation, along with potential allies in the sport fishing community and some local grassroots environmental organizations. And over the course of 28 years and four separate mine managements, there were increasing levels of opposition to that mining project. And one of the leading tools in opposing that mining project was the assertion of sovereign treaty rights by the Mole Lake Sikagan Ojibwa tribe. These treaty rights derive from their status as sovereign nations and have been affirmed under provisions in both the Clean Water and the Clean Air Act. And in 1995, when they received authorization from the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate water quality that flowed through their reservation from the mine site, the state of Wisconsin immediately took measures to oppose the actions of the Environmental Protection Agency through a number of court cases that were supported by the mining companies. And over the course of the next 4 years, the tribe successfully fought off the attempts of the state of Wisconsin to assert jurisdiction over their waters on their reservation, along with the support of the surrounding non-Indian community and the people downstream on the Wolf River, where the mine waste would have been discharged from the Exxon Crandon mine. As a result of that unprecedented alliance between Indian tribes, environmentalists, and sport fishers, both the company and the state lost the clean water case or the water rights case, and the company decided that they could not successfully get a mine permitted that would meet the requirements of the Mole Lake tribe. And so the lesson I drew from this is that people ought not to expect the state to defend their rights, that the alternatives are the sovereign power of the community, and in this case, the sovereign power of an Indian tribe.
If you want to learn more about Al Geddick's work, go to the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council at wrpc.net. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening. And remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Union Edge, followed by KBOO's new show focusing on LGBT issues at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is going to be hotter than today, and each day following will be hotter than the day before. Mark Twain says, climate is what we expect. Weather is what we get.
It's 5:24 p.m. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
President Obama is miffed that nearly all of his fellow Democrats in the U.S. House recently refused to follow him over the cliff of yet another global trade deal. But ironically, it was the core of his own argument that led Democrats to hand such an embarrassing and deserved defeat to him. Simply put, Obama pleaded, America has to write the rules of the 21st century economy in a way that benefits American workers. Nice sentiment, but simply put, the claim that his Trans-Pacific Partnership scheme would benefit American workers is a scam. Democratic lawmakers knew that America had not written the 1,000 pages of rules the president was pushing. In the secret, closed-door negotiating sessions, the tiny fraction of Americans allowed inside were such corporate powers as AT&T, GE, the Koch brothers, and Walmart. Workers themselves were not at the table, nor were consumers, small business, environmentalists, family farmers, and all the other real people who know from experience that the old saying is true, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Sure enough, the rules of the 21st century economy that Obama's TPP deal would impose on us is a raw deal, rigged against people for the benefit of global corporate interests. For example, the rules would raise our medicine prices, offshore more of our jobs, undermine our food safety and environmental protections, and even allow multinational corporations to usurp our people's sovereignty by suing the U.S. government in special corporate tribunals over laws and rules they don't like. This is Jim Hightower saying, Obama is mad at House Democrats, but people back home are furious at him for trying to sell us out. As Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi put it, when members went back to their districts, quote, we put our hand on a very hot stove of public opposition.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A heat wave has killed more than 400 people in Pakistan's southern city of Karachi over the past 3 days. The country's military has set up emergency medical camps in the streets and is administering immediate care. The death toll is expected to spike in coming days as officials start counting those who died. About 700 people have died across the country. In neighboring India, about 2,500 people died from high temperatures during a heat wave in May. In a study published in The Lancet on Tuesday, predicts a 12-fold increase in the global population's vulnerability to heat waves by the end of the century due to climate change and population effects.
And now, something a little different from H2O Radio, This Week in Water.
Toxic threat shuts down West Coast fisheries. That and other stories for the week ending June 21st, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Last Thursday, Pope Francis released his encyclical letter entitled On Care for Our Common Home.
In the 192-page document, the Pope mentioned water 46 times, and he devoted one entire section to the issue of water.
The scope of the papal letter was broad and detailed. Reactions to the document were somewhat predictable, and instead of trying to trace those reactions or forecast the possible effects of the Pope's message, we give you some of his most significant points about water.
He said fresh drinking water is an issue of primary importance. Water poverty especially affects Africa, where large sectors of the population have no access to safe drinking water.
Further, he said, it is conceivable that the control of water by large multinational businesses may become a major source of conflict in this century.
The pontiff stressed that the oceans not only contain the bulk of our planet's water supply, but also most of the immense variety of living creatures, many of them still unknown to us and threatened for various reasons.
And lastly, Francis expressed concern that there is a growing tendency, despite its scarcity, to privatize water, turning it into a commodity subject to the law of the market.
The Pope's encyclical highlights how issues of social justice are at the heart of the environmental crisis.
In the West African country of Ghana, 50 people drowned directly due to flooding that occurred about 2 weeks ago. Some of the causes of the deaths were blocked drains and poor infrastructure.
In what the government says was an effort to deal with the problem, on Saturday, officials bulldozed hundreds of homes and businesses in an extremely poor section of Accra, actually called Sodom and Gomorrah. Authorities said the purpose was to start widening and dredging a lagoon for flood control.
Reuters reports that residents said they were tear-gassed when they tried to protect their homes and livelihoods.
By Saturday evening, thousands of people were stranded in the rain in a stretch of rubble more than a mile long.
Last week, we learned that 21 of 37 of the world's greatest aquifers are being depleted faster than they can be recharged. The finding comes from NASA researchers and concludes that draining the underground lakes poses a long-term threat to freshwater supply.
The areas with severe aquifer stress are in India, northern China, and California's Central Valley. The most groundwater depletion is in the Arabian aquifer system in the Middle East.
Throughout the world, groundwater supplies 2 billion people with water, and according to NASA's Jay Famigliette, there will be less replenishment of these aquifers due to climate change.
A massive algal bloom, possibly one of the largest ever, has formed off the U.S. West Coast, stretching from California and possibly as far north as Alaska.
The bloom, which first appeared in May, has forced commercial and recreational shellfish operations up and down the coast to close. State agencies have put out warnings about harvesting and eating several species of clams, mussels, anchovies, and sardines.
Algal blooms happen when microscopic marine algae, also known as phytoplankton, proliferate in huge numbers, causing a buildup of toxins such as domoic acid, a powerful and fatal neurotoxin. Domoic acid can end up in anything that feeds off the algae, then works its way up the food chain to poison birds and marine mammals.
High concentrations of algae aren't uncommon, but typically they occur in the fall when ocean temperatures are at their warmest. Scientists suspect this historic bloom is linked to a patch of unusually warm water off the West Coast, first observed in the fall of 2013 and deemed the blob. Though the blob has since dissipated, ocean temperatures remain about 2 degrees Celsius warmer than normal.
The warm waters have also drawn northward a number of creatures seldom or never previously seen, such as a sunfish in the Gulf of Alaska, mahi-mahi off the coast of Oregon, and a Pacific sea turtle common in the Galapagos near San Francisco.
It gets even stranger. For the past few weeks, tiny red crabs by the thousands have washed up on beaches in Southern California. According to Scripps Institute of Oceanography, the crustacean's habitat is usually off Baja California, but the warmer waters have funneled them up northward.
And in the San Francisco Bay Area, giant purple sea slugs, some as big as 30 inches across, have slimed East Bay beaches, prompting calls to local officials about a creepy invasion.
And speaking of terrifying things in the ocean, today marks the 40th anniversary of the release of the blockbuster Jaws. And although the epic had us nervous about things lurking in the deep, a scarier proposition is what happens if climate change continues unabated. In that case, we're all going to need a bigger boat.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
New York City has agreed to begin reforms at Rikers Island, the country's second largest jail system. Some of the reforms to take place include new policies restricting violence against inmates by guards, installing thousands of surveillance cameras, and a focus on the safety of teenage inmates. The settlement will also include requirements for reporting violence by correction officers. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York says that this comprehensive framework requires the city to implement sweeping operational changes to fix a broken system and dismantle a decades-long culture of violence. Rikers Island is where 22-year-old Khalif Browder committed suicide after spending 3 brutal years in the prison. The recent settlement is part of a large investigation on violence and corruption at Rikers Island.
South Carolina lawmakers have introduced a bill to take down Confederate battle flag. The bill would bar the flag from being flown on the state grounds. The action followed a morning of demonstrations in which civil rights activists and politicians rallied on the steps of the State House in Columbia, demanding that lawmakers take it down. The bill introduced in the state Senate will provide for permanent removal of the South Carolina infantry battle flag of the Confederate States of America from its location adjacent to the Confederate Soldier Monument and put it in the Relic Room for appropriate display. 28 senators, including Republican Paul Thurmond, sponsored the measure. The State House Clerk's Office confirmed to Al Jazeera. Thurmond is the son of Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond, had earlier called for the flag to come down. He says, "I'm proud to be on the right side of history to remove this symbol of racism and bigotry from the State House. For the rebel flag to be permanently removed from state grounds, the bill must receive at least 2/3 approval by the General Assembly, which includes the House and Senate."
Ever read an email and then accidentally hit send before you've actually finished? Maybe leaving off an attachment or sending something to the wrong person? Now, Google is letting people use its Gmail email service to undo those mistakes, at least if you're quick. The company has added a setting to Gmail, giving users the option of adding a short delay before the email actually goes out. Gmail users can now have from 5 to 30 seconds after pressing send to cancel their message. This feature is an optional setting and must be switched on to start working, so until you update your Gmail settings, you won't be able to cancel that late-night email to your boss.
According to the new Department of Defense Law of War Manual, journalists can be considered the enemy. The War Manual states that, in general, journalists are civilians. However, journalists may be members of the armed forces, persons authorized to accompany the armed forces, or unprivileged belligerents. The term unprivileged belligerents, by the way, is a replacement for the term enemy combatants that was popular among warfighters during the Bush era.
A report by the World Health Organization shows that the insecticide lindane causes cancer in humans. A panel of specialists found that lindane can be linked to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Lindane has been largely banned by the U.S. and in Europe, but is still used in some developing countries. It is an ingredient found in head lice and scabies treatments that are used in some countries, including China, India, the U.S., and Canada. Evidence linking lindane cancer was largely based on studies among agricultural workers that showed a consistent, approximately 50% increase in risk, with higher risks in heavily exposed agricultural workers. The agricultural usage of lindane has been severely restricted starting in the 1970s, and current general population exposure is mainly through the diet or when treated for scabies or lice.
The U.S. military is moving a large number of tanks and other heavy equipment to Central and Eastern Europe. This move comes as tensions between NATO and Russia continue to escalate. Up to 250 tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, and self-propelled howitzers are being put in position in the Baltic states, as well as Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. Some equipment will also be placed in Germany. The Russian government, not surprisingly, has denounced the move as a return to the Cold War, and Russian President Vladimir Putin is threatening to add 40 nuclear missiles to its arsenal in response.
Kurdish fighters and their allies have captured a military base controlled by the Daesh, or ISIL. The base is near the city of Raqqa in northern Syria. The Daesh fighters had taken control of the base in August 2014. This development was the second major setback for ISIL in northern Syria in the past 2 weeks, after Kurdish fighters and allied rebel factions last week captured the nearby town of Tal Abyad on the Turkish border. Since Tal Abyad was liberated last week, a steady stream of people have been returning, and sources have told Al Jazeera that ample quantities of bread and other food supplies are already available in the town. Andrew Tabler, an expert on Syria at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, described the capturing of Tal Abyad as a significant blow for ISIL, because it cuts off one of its main transit routes used to smuggle supplies, weapons, and fighters.
Two ancient shrines in the ancient city of Palmyra have been destroyed by Daesh, also known as ISIL. The Daesh militants captured the town in May. At the same time, it was feared by many that they would continue the practice by destroying antiquities that they see as sacrilegious. And now, it seems they have. The Syrian chief of antiquities says that in all the areas where they spread, when they see tombs, they destroy them because they see them as sacrilegious and a return to paganism. The tombs destroyed were Muhammad bin Ali, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad's cousin, and Nisir Abu Bahanuddin, a religious figure from Palmyra.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh, Shade Samuelson, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. Stay tuned tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving guest hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. Her guest is Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland, who will talk about recent news and events. At 9, on Political Perspectives, we'll hear Radio Eco Shock, featuring Dr. Robert Kopp explaining why humans die in heat waves and why that will get worse with climate change developing. Then Dr. Jeremy Leggett talks about winning the carbon war. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 11, Stephanie Potter hosts The Recovery Zone. Her guest is author and poet Martin Prechtel, who talks about his new book, The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for the Union Edge.
Welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. And please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. And, you know, sometimes, folks, when you make a mistake, sometimes it's okay. And sometimes you really just want to kick yourself with it. And I'm kicking myself right now. But long story short, we'll try and fix it. And we'll tell you about that one later. But joining me today from Work in Progress Radio, Teamsters Local 406 and the Community Action Teams, we've got Jim Chase. Jim, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Charles. It's wonderful to be on today.
It's always a pleasure, man. It's always a pleasure. We appreciate it. I just wish I could tell time right, but that's another story. Long and short of this is a lot of things going on. First of all, you guys have like a dozen different organizing drives going on. How's that going?
Yeah, there's lots of calls.